This is Residents in a Room, an official podcast of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, where we go behind the scenes to explore the world from the point of view of anesthesiology residents.
I refer to residency as the great equalizer because only in residency are you really working closely with other folks and collaborative opportunities that we have all the time as anesthesiologists to try to influence the lives of young people. And I think we should seize upon that opportunity to do so. And he grabs him by his shirt and tie. He pushes him against the wall. He gets his face right up in the other side.
Hello, I'm Dr. Courtney Salinas, current CA3 at University of Washington. Welcome to Residents in a Room, ASA's podcast for residents by residents. Today, we're going to eavesdrop on a conversation recorded for our sister podcast, Central Line. Dr. William McDade, Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer for the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, talked to Dr. Adam Stryker, the host of Central Line, about standardized tests, what diversity means to ACGME, and the true value and necessity of diversifying the healthcare workforce. As someone who's personally passionate about diversity in medicine and working towards health equity for our patients, I learned so much from this conversation. I think it's worth sharing with you, my fellow residents. So let's listen in.
Typically, we use the words diversity, equity, and inclusion quite a bit. And I wonder if you can disentangle those words for all of us, actually, and what each of those truly means.
Well, diversity is an interesting concept because it's really morphed from other things. I mean, when I started in the dean's office at the University of Chicago, I was the dean for multicultural affairs because people recognized that people of different ethnicities and backgrounds had different histories that came into the situation that we're in right now. It was based in culture. And then that morphed to other areas as well, so that you could have ability or you could have gender or you could have, you know, any sort of other sort of parameter that people could all describe themselves as, because everybody has a culture. Everybody has an identity. And so the idea of diversity really has now morphed into a much larger sort of comprehensive goal. But let me focus what we were trying to do at ACGME. Our goal is to improve healthcare and population health. And one of the biggest problems that I think we face in our society here in the US is health disparities, racial and ethnic health disparities. That is the premature death and the excess burden of disease that occurs in some communities on the basis of race and ethnicity. And this really was pointed out to us in 2002 when the Institute of Medicine, then now the National Academy of Medicine, published a book called Unequal Treatment. It was about 600 pages, and it detailed a broad expanse of disease categories in which minority people in general were outstripping the majority population with respect to disease burden. And it really impacted almost every entity in healthcare, from hospitals to clinical situations to all over with respect to the diseases that minority people face. And so if you'd like to try to think of the disease burden carried by minority people as the disparity, when we think about diversity at ACGME, we're thinking about building a workforce that's more likely to help us to eliminate those health disparities. That was really the goal of Healthy People 2010, when it started Healthy People 2020 now. And one of the foci of that was to try to create a workforce that's going to be more likely to serve to reduce those disparities. Well, you ask yourself, well what group is that? And so it turns out that there's a disproportionate rate of minority physicians who see minority patients. And if you look across disciplines, you'll see that if you're an African-American physician, you're about 23 times more likely to see an African-American patient than as a white physician. If you're a Latinx doctor, you're about 19 times more likely to see a Latinx patient than a white doctor. If you're an Asian physician, you're about 26 more times likely to see an Asian patient than a white physician. If you speak only Spanish in your home, you're about 18 times more likely to see a Latinx physician than if you are a white physician. And why would this be? Well, William Julius Wilson, the sociologist at Harvard, would argue that it's because, in fact, we live in hyper-segregated communities in the United States, and that the tendency to see a physician of your same race is that strong, that powerful in primary care. A group studied this and saw that the tendency to see a Black primary care physician, if you're Black, is about 40 times greater than a primary care physician who's white seeing a black patient. And because of the way that we live and the barriers that exist between communities, even if there aren't fences there, it stops people from being able to see that physician who's different than them because of other things like trust or the ability to communicate or the ability to follow through on medical advice in racially discongruent relationships, discordant relationships. And so the diversity we're seeking is to try to figure out who's going to more likely serve that community that's going to help us to improve healthcare. And the answer to that, to some extent, is people who bear that great burden of disease and who share the same sort of backgrounds as those individuals who are suffering from those diseases. So I'm looking primarily at racial and ethnic disparities, but that doesn't mean that's the entire panoply of diversity. We have fields in medicine, say orthopedic surgeon, where only 14% of orthopedic surgeons are women. And so if you look at all of the specialties, there's an axis of diversity, I think, that pertains to everyone. If we collect the data on LGBTQ, I am confident we would find that there are disparities that might be improved and if we had a workforce that was more likely to serve LGBTQ communities. People with disabilities or differently abled people certainly have an impact on healthcare and considerations around healthcare that can be improved by enriching the workforce in those individuals. And so the way that we're interpreting this at ACGME is that diversity is defined locally by the hospital or the academic medical center or the sponsor institution that's around it. And whatever that institution sees in their community as a need to try to increase diversity to address a healthcare disparity, that's the group I think that we need to focus on. So it's a little different. Instead of thinking about the identity around what we'd like to describe ourselves or like what we'd like to call ourselves, we're thinking about the functionality of the physician that's produced that will really eliminate an issue in disparity. And that's how I'd like to really think about diversity. Now let's go on to equity. So equity really is best envisioned. So imagine there's a baseball game and everyone wants to look over a wooden fence in order to see it, but you've got three people of differing heights. You've got someone who's very, very small, someone who's kind of intermediate size, but still can't see over the fence. And then you have someone who can really see over the fence very well. Imagine if you gave each one a box that they can stand on. So you give the shortest person a box that she can stand on, the intermediate person a box, and the tallest person a box. That would be referred to as equality. Everybody gets the same box, but the little one still can't see over the fence. The intermediate one now can just get his head over the fence and see the game. The tall person didn't need the box in the first place, but still stands on the box because it's all equal. Equity means giving people what they need to be successful. So the tall person didn't really even need a box in the first place. Don't give them a box. The intermediate person needed just one box in order to see over the fence, but the shorter person needed two boxes. And now with two boxes, she can see the game, the intermediate person can see the game, and now the tall person can see the game, and everybody benefits. Now let's imagine, instead of having a wooden fence, we had a chain link fence, that everybody can see the game from where they stood to begin with. And that's what we refer to as liberation. You remove the barrier, you've taken it completely away so that you don't need a box in order to see the game. So that's what I think of in the term equality, equity, and liberation. They all are a spectrum of what one needs to be successful. And the last thing is inclusion. Inclusion, in my way of thinking, is really just a way to make sure that diversity works. That if you bring people into an environment that's not inclusive, they're not going to be successful. If you have to figure out ways of in order to make people feel welcomed and belonging in an environment, then that's what inclusion is there for. So what do you have to do? You have to mitigate the biases, the thoughts that really work against an individual, and discrimination, the acts that actually work against an individual. You have to remove microaggressions or those elements that really are toxic to the environment of somebody who is different than other people in the organization. You have to figure out how to remove stereotype threat, which is a way in which society has said that this person should be viewed. And that person actually internalizes it and believes it themselves. Kamara Jones would actually refer to that as internalized racism. The individualized racism that exists in society is really the racism that everyone thinks about. It's the acts of bad people. And we're not really so much focused on that. We're focused on really the acts that are just built into the system as norms. They're part of the normal structure, and that we don't really see them because they're woven into the fabric of society. Getting rid of structural racism is really the most important thing that we can do. When we find that things disparately affect one group as opposed to another and advantage one group, the dominant group, as opposed to marginalized groups, that's something that we have to work on as a society to remove. And that makes our environment more inclusive. When we take down those unspoken rules or those barriers that persist that keep people down, the headwinds that marginalized people face. And so when we're thinking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, it's about finding, you know, the broadest group of people with whatever they bring to the equation that's going to improve healthcare. We're thinking about equity to make sure that they get what they need in order to be successful. If they don't need so much, then don't give them as much as they otherwise could be given. But those people who need more, you give more to. And then inclusion, make the environment welcoming so that they feel a sense of belonging so they can be the most successful they can be in achieving their goals.
There's a couple things I want to get to here. First question I have related to diversity or disparity in healthcare. Do you think that that is a major hurdle for the medical community to understand that this is about approaching it from the patient's perspective and getting everyone the access to healthcare that they would otherwise not have without the diversity in the workforce? I get the sense, and maybe this is wrong, that perhaps a large percentage of the medical community feels that this is simply about making everything look the same and that we're just doing it because we want to make sure we're representing every group, but not really approaching it from the patient's perspective.
No, that's not it at all. So one of the things that I did to look at this problem was I looked at the American Medical Association Health Workforce Mapper, which is a tool, a geo tool that allows you to put a dot where every physician practices in the United States as a function of zip code. And so if you look at Chicago, for instance, you'll see a nice cluster of cardiologists in blue dots around the University of Chicago. And you'll see another cluster around Northwestern. And you'll see across the North Shore line of Lake Michigan on Chicago, a number of cardiology practices. And then you'll see some sprinkled through the north side of Chicago. But when you look at the south side of Chicago, not so much. And so the idea is, In a community like Englewood, which is just west on the other side of I-94 from the University of Chicago, people don't actually go from Englewood east to the University of Chicago for their care. And you say, well, why? Well, it gets back to the idea of trust, of having a physician who cares about your community and wants to work in your community. And it's about access in general, that will the insurance that I have be accepted by the physicians who are just on the other side of I-94? No one has a cardiology practice in Englewood. And if you look at the life expectancy of the people who live in Englewood, as in the New York Times article back in September, you'll see the life expectancy is 60 years old in Englewood, compared to Streeterville, a community that's just around where Northwestern is on the near north side of Chicago, where it's 90 years old. So a 30-year mortality gap exists between two communities that are a short train ride apart. And it's because of the access that people have, and it's because of the willingness to see physicians who are different than you, or the willingness of physicians to actually see patients from those communities in part. So here's the problem. I can teach everybody who goes to medical school about cultural competence or cultural humility or all the things that we think are necessary to eliminate healthcare disparities in their practices, which are things that ACGME wants you to do. But the problem is that if you don't co-locate in a place where people who have these marginal life expectancies live, then you won't have much of an impact on the healthcare disparities that exist in our society. So what you have to do is find individuals who are more likely to practice in these underserved areas in order to make a dent. And so if you ask first-year medical students, as the AAMC does in their matriculating student questionnaire, whether they're going to practice in a community that's underserved when they graduate, 60% of African-American medical students will say that. 50% of Native American indigenous medical students will say that. Around 44% of Latinx physicians will say, physicians in training will say that in their first year of medical school. Then you ask them again at the medical student graduation questionnaire whether you plan to practice in an underserved area. Native Americans, still at 50%. African-Americans, down around 45%. Latinx individuals, down around 32%. Whites and Asians, around in the teens. And so when people graduate, where do they practice? Well, they practice in areas that have a large number of people who look like them. And because of the hypersegregation that we talked about, it's really easy to put yourself in those communities if you're an African-American or Latinx or an indigenous physician. It sometimes is harder, despite the fact that the numbers are larger, to find white and Asian physicians who want to practice in those areas. So the answer is, can you fix the health disparities that exist in our country simply by teaching everybody about the things that you should do right when caring for people who are different than you? And the answer is no, that you still need to make people who are more likely to practice in those areas and serve those people on a regular basis in order to make the dent that we need to make. And so the author and activist, Brian Stevenson, who wrote the book Just Mercy and runs the Equal Justice Initiative down in Alabama, spoke to the AAMC annual Learn, Serve, Lead conference last fall. And what he suggested is that there's an empathy gap in our society, that we allow health disparities to persist because of the separation that we have between communities in the United States, that because we live in enclaves of people who are much like us in this hyper-segregated environment, we don't see the people who are really carrying the greatest burden of disease. And so they don't exist to the reality that we would otherwise know if we experienced them directly on a regular basis. And because we aren't proximate to the suffering, Brian would actually say that we don't really appreciate the urgency that we have to put behind getting rid of these disparities. And that's the problem. Václav Havel actually said the same thing. Sometimes we have to be willing to get into those difficult situations to be proximate to the suffering of individuals to really want to change it. And I think we're now seeing it to a large degree. This past summer, with the racial unrest that took place after the murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery, now it's coming into our view that we see that people are being treated differently on the basis of race. And then we see COVID that overlaps with this, that shows that COVID has had a disproportionate impact on people who have underlying health disparities. And because of those two synergistic relationships, we are now seeing even more clearly that the disparities that we've existed with in health for such a long time have a greater impact than we otherwise would have thought, because now we see people who are dying in disproportion. In Chicago, of the first 100 people who died of COVID, 70 of them were African-American. So it's right here for us to see. And we have to really be intentionally ignoring it in order not to see it.
But do you feel that the current medical community understands all this, or is that a hurdle that needs to be overcome? It's noble and necessary, but are the current physicians understanding of that?
Well, I will tell you, after the George Floyd situation in Minnesota this summer, a number of healthcare organizations had people who came out en masse holding signs that said that they were in support. A number of organizations wrote statements that really decried the current system and demanded equal justice in terms of healthcare access and the ability to eliminate health disparities through whatever means that we could marshal in order to do that. Are there people who have lagged? Yes. And we have to work with them to help to bring them along. But the ACGME has started to really move in that direction. For the last 10 years, we've been looking at ways to reduce health disparities through educating the C-suite on the necessity to do that. And we're seeing some movement there. And then a year ago, we started program requirements that enjoined residents in partnership with their sponsoring institutions to engage in a mission-driven, ongoing, systematic approach to increase recruitment and retention of a diverse workforce and provide inclusive learning environments. And that diverse workforce included residents and fellows, faculty, other GME staff, and other academic folks who might be involved in the GME effort. Now every program has that as a requirement. And so my hope is that medicine will learn along the way that these are important things to strive for, and that the people who we educate in graduate medical education programs, and the ACGME now is the sole accreditor of all the residencies and most of the fellowships in the country. So everyone's going to come through a program where this was required of it. We hope to be able to move the needle on this in ways that we never could before when this didn't exist in graduate medical education. So you could come through a domestic medical school, and the LCME has a similar requirement. But, you know, you recognize that 25% of the physicians who train in America didn't come from LCME accredited schools. And so now everybody is going to have this as a goal in their training programs, and hopefully they'll carry it with them long into their practice.
Is there anything that's holding you back from making any further progress?
Well, obviously the structural racism that exists in society is a barrier. Because structural racism is one of those things that is unseen. It's racism without racists. It really looks at outcomes, it looks at processes, as opposed to the acts of individuals. You know, things that have become normative, things that have become the usual, the standard way that we interpret things. The myth of meritocracy, that's all built into structurally racist sort of concepts that have been built up that have really caused the differential that exists between education, between the wealth gap that exists between blacks and whites in society here, and a number of the barriers in healthcare that prevent good health. I mean, obviously the social determinants of health are all predicated in structural entities that are historical and are persistent because of the way that our society works. Those are the targets of the things that we have to try to change in order to really advance healthcare equity. And that's really the goal, is to try to make sure that everybody has what they need in order to achieve good health.
What would you say to people that might say, okay, well, I understand what you're saying, but ultimately, you know, we're talking about physicians, and physicians need to be able to do the job and be competent and to have aptitudes in math and science. And I get what you're trying to do, but I want to make sure that we have people that actually can do the work of being a physician. Have you gotten that question before? And what would you say to that?
Well, you know, there was an unfortunate article that was published in the Journal of the American Heart Association that has since been retracted. And what it alleged is that by lowering standards, quote unquote, by looking at other parameters other than the standardized exams that have been historically used to say that there's a person who did well on the exam who's of higher quality than a person who didn't do so well. The problem with thinking like that is that the tests actually measure the competence and the outcomes of physicians who have those sorts of scores. So David Ash performed an important series of experiments or studies back in 2009, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And what he looked at was the practice outcomes of OBGYN doctors with respect to their complication rates. And he looked to see whether or not their USMLE score or their MCAT score or their passage on the ABMS certification exam varied with respect to their care for patients in practice. And what he found is that the thing that actually made the most difference in what the quality was or what the complication rate was of a practicing obstetrician gynecologist for the next 17 years of their practice was where they trained. If they trained in an institution that had a low complication rate, they maintained a low complication rate relative to their peers for the next 17 years. If they trained in a place that had a high complication rate, what they found is that they practiced with a high complication rate for the next 17 years. The idea that individual qualities on aptitude tests or on placement exams or on standardized exams actually tells you how good a physician you're going to be, how low your complication rate is going to be in practice, didn't correlate at all. And so if you're trying to produce physicians who are going to give the best care to patients, who are going to have the lowest complication rates, who are going to serve people who aren't served right now, I think we may be looking at the wrong sorts of things, and that we measure the things that we can measure because they're easy for us to measure. That to have an exam that allows us to say that somebody does better on a quantitative exam or than somebody else means that they've had more time to practice. They've had more access to practice. They've taken more practice tests. They paid the $5,000 or $7,000 that you need to have in order to do review courses that many people can't afford who come from more disadvantaged backgrounds. Jordy Cohn, in an article also in JAMA on the premature abandonment of affirmative action in medicine, showed a graph that I thought was very telling, that for underrepresented minority students, income matters the most for your MCAT performance, and that the lower your parental income, the lower your MCAT score. The higher your parental income, the higher your MCAT score, and that the difference was greater for African-American, Latinx, and Native Americans than it was for whites and Asians. So what we're saying is that the historical wealth gap that's generated because of slavery and subsequent oppression that really causes this difference in wealth is really responsible at the core for the difference in performance on standardized exams. Yet, the communities that are suffering from greatest health disparities are also the ones where the people who are the victims of this oppression need to go back and practice in order to help to eliminate health disparities. So that's the dichotomy that we're really looking at in this, is that there are other things that matter other than the performance on a standardized exam, and that you can actually be a really good doctor, but maybe you don't score so well on standardized exam. There's a phenomenon that the psychologist Claude Steele referred to as stereotype threat. It's reinforced in environments that really are not inclusive, where people are made to doubt that they belong in the environment, something we refer to as imposter syndrome. And stereotype threat is really one of those things that generates the performance that you see people have on standardized exams. What it best is shown by is by women who are in their sophomore year of college and are asked to take the math portion of the SAT. You can take half of the group of women and tell them that women typically underperform on these math exams compared to men, and then you can say absolutely nothing to the other group. And you'll find that consistently the women who are given the message before the exam that women don't perform as well as men underperform on the exam. You can reverse that phenomenon by telling the women at the beginning of the exam that women typically outperform men on these types of exams. Women show no difference in performance than the women who are told absolutely nothing. If you try to do this with a cognitive exam and race, where you have a marginalized group, African-Americans, say, and you tell them that African-Americans typically outperform non-African-Americans on a cognitive exam, they don't believe you. It's internalized with those individuals so much by everything that's seen in society that just by giving them the mere suggestion that their thoughts about this will be different doesn't affirm them and doesn't help them. So what happens during the course of a test for somebody who's the victim of stereotype threat? Well, you engage in something called rumination, which is you start thinking about all of those parameters that are involved with you're not doing well on that exam potentially, and what would happen. So you're thinking, if I don't do as well on this exam as they expect me to, they're not going to give me another chance. They're not going to let another person in this program who looks like me. I know I'm not supposed to be here because I'm the only African-American in my program. I'm the first African-American in this program. You know, if I don't do well on this exam, my whole family is going to be out of money because I'm going to be the person who everyone looks to for money. Now, you're thinking all of this while you're doing question one. Meanwhile, everybody else has moved on to question four. And so in a speeded exam, those people who engage in rumination don't perform as well as those who don't have stereotype threat and who aren't engaged in rumination and who are just objectively answering the questions. So nobody thinks about this as why people underperform on exams unless you really understand what stereotype threat's all about. And that's why inclusiveness is so important. You can reduce those sorts of barriers. And what I find in residency is, I refer to residency as the great equalizer, because only in residency are you really working closely with other folks in collaborative learning environments. In medical school, people are excluded, marginalized from study groups. Pre-med, it certainly happens. But once you get to residency program, the cohorts are so small and people work together so well because you're exchanging information, you're handing off to people who are caring for your same patients, that you have to develop an esprit de corps. And what happens with that is you learn something that is really important. And that is that the internalized racism that said that whites and Asians are superior intellectually to you as an African-American isn't true. They present and you think of things that they could have said better. You understand a little bit more about the clinical problem than they did. They have the same questions that you have. And so what you see is, by working closely with people shoulder to shoulder over the course of a residency, you dispel the notion of racial superiority. You teach as a senior resident junior residents who are of a different race than you. That dispels myths that they may have about white superiority. That may dispel myths that you have as the fact, because you now teach people who look up to you. And that sort of thing is something that many African-Americans never get a chance to experience. And by having this dynamic broken, you can actually perform on standardized exams much better than you could before when you were ruminating and dealing with stereotype threat. So it's really an important concept to understand that performance isn't just about, you know, knowledge and quality and all the rest of that. There are factors that transcend that. And the importance of what those individuals will do once they graduate and commit to a career in medicine, I think far out exceeds what marginal differences that may exist on standardized exams.
Well, are medical schools getting that? Those are compelling arguments. Are the medical schools getting that messaging? Are they able to actually take that messaging and operationalize that in some fashion?
I think that many medical schools are moving to holistic admissions and situational judgment tests that are trying to tease out these things. The MCAT 2015 is now putting in social science questions and questions that really test the ability of individuals to think about things more broadly than just biology, chemistry, physics, and organic chemistry. The idea that other things matter, that the psychological sciences and that biostatistics makes a difference. You know, when I looked at the breakdown of individuals as a function of race and which residency programs that they predominate in, and African Americans and Latinx individuals are overrepresented by their numbers in the primary care fields, as you might expect, especially areas greatly underrepresented. But one of the things that shocked me about African Americans is that they represent 12.5% of all the people who are in preventive medicine programs. That means that those are people who are thinking about public health issues and occupational health issues and in areas that really transcend just the practice of medicine per se, but are thinking about the larger social context of medicine. Those things that the disparities in care that are related to social factors play a role in are the things that people understand when you come from these sorts of communities are important. So I will just say that medical schools are getting it. And what you see now is really unfortunate. And one of the things that I think is important about understanding standardized testing is that when you look at MCAT performance, African-American mean score of MCATs in the lowest 13% of everybody who takes the MCAT, right? If you imagine that once those people are seen and reviewed by admissions committees, they're not going to get into medical school if you're in the lowest 13%. What we see is that the tail of that distribution may go all the way to the top. It's a really thin tail. The majority of people are down by that mean score. And then if you look at the people who get admitted to medical school, and this is data out of UC Riverside that I just saw not too long ago, that the mean African-American score is in the lowest 0.7th percentile of individuals who are admitted to medical school. So I think people in medical school get it. But the problem is that if you say we're going to waive parameters on admissions tests to get you into medical school, but we're not going to waive those sorts of parameters when you get to residency, you can then see how people who don't have very many opportunities to test and don't have the resources to provide you with the background that will help you to supplement your performance on these exams may suffer. And that's exactly what we see. That we'll see that USMLE Step 1 scores are much lower for African Americans than they are for majority students. And if program directors use those scores as a measure of quality, keeping people out of programs that or types of programs on the basis of having a threshold because they can be more selective of performance on a standardized exam, then you're going to be underrepresented in those fields. And so we have to look very carefully at that. One of the things I was very pleased to see is that USMLE, the committee, said that they're now going to remove the three-digit score and look at a pass-fail score for USMLE Step 1. Now, many program directors would say, well, that's to our detriment because we don't have the ability to go through applications and figure out these sorts of differences that might be nuanced without a three-digit score that allows us to do what's easy in order to sort. And what I would argue is that maybe it's not supposed to be easy. Maybe you're supposed to have to read some of these essays and really look at the applications and try to figure out ways in which you can actually change the way that the field has functioned in the past so that we can try to eliminate these health disparities that we've been so unsuccessful at remedying over the last several generations.
That actually brings me to another question. Are there other barriers that the medical schools have identified with regard to sorting out all their applicants? You already answered the point about having a numerical test score versus pass-fail. Are there other logistical barriers that they are citing?
Well, I will tell you that of the people, going back to African-Americans again, of the African-Americans who take the MCAT, half do not actually apply to medical school. And you say, well, why is that? In part, It's because it's the counseling that people get before they get into medical school or they're in the application process. There are countless stories of individuals who've been discouraged by college counselors to apply to medical school based on an MCAT score or a grade in organic chemistry. And yet we've seen examples of individuals who still went ahead and applied who've been extraordinarily successful subsequently for all the reasons I talked about before. Anthony Abraham Jack published a wonderful book called The Privileged Poor, which really talks about the plight of underrepresented minority students who come from what he refers to as doubly disadvantaged communities, as opposed to similar individuals who are given access to elite pre-college opportunities, and then compare those to people from upper income levels who are very familiar with the things that occur on elite campuses. And medical schools still draw many of their students from these elite campuses, so it's very important to look at this. And so what he showed is that if you don't understand how to navigate the college pathway, understanding what office hours mean, understanding that you may have to work, but there's certain jobs that you can work that actually pay you, but you don't have to be disengaged from academics at the same time that you're doing those sorts of jobs. Those are the sorts of things that it takes someone who understands the college process coming into it, who's had a parent, who has had a sib, or has some had exposure in the environments to understand how to best navigate. And the doubly disadvantaged people who didn't go to an elite pre-college high school don't understand it and perform less well. And so we lose those individuals in the first couple of years of college, and they're discouraged from applying. One of the things that I think would be essential to do that has not yet happened is in the medical school admissions requirements book, now websites, that talk about the parameters of medical schools. We often look at the data there and say, well, I'd never fit in that medical school, because the data that shows up in the MSAR is really the average MCAT score or the average GPA of a medical school student. But as I just told you, on the MCAT score, African Americans are in the lowest 0.7 percentile. So it's the range that's really important in making decisions about whether you should apply to a medical school or not. And unfortunately, that data is not made available to us. I think it should be, because it would help people to think about not counseling themselves out of a career in medicine when they otherwise could. Association of American Medical Colleges put together a website several years ago, over a decade ago now, called aspiringdocs.org. And it really talks about some of those other barriers that cause people to self-select out. That is the idea of generating $200,000 in debt when your family may be a rental family because you can't afford a house. Only 40% of African Americans actually own houses in the United States because of the wealth gap I spoke of before. So how could you possibly think about going into $200,000 of debt if you're from a family that doesn't have a house, or a family that has a house that maybe only costs $50,000 or $60,000? So that's the sort of mentality that has to be overcome in order to get people in the door to consider careers in medicine. Now, once you get them in to a pre-medical program or a college program, you've got to think about the things that they need in order to be successful. This idea of giving someone what they need to be successful, equity, is something that doesn't happen in very many colleges. And so what medical schools look for are individuals who have had those sorts of privileges, I suppose. Those things that are able to allow those students to compete. And there are a lot of them out there, and we've got to get more of them into the practice of medicine. And so that's another one of the parameters. The other thing that I think we have to go back to is think about the humanistic level that individuals show when we're thinking about who belongs in medicine. If you tell me, and I interviewed thousands of medical school students because I was on the admissions committee at the University of Chicago 17 years, and I used to chair it. You ask people why they want to be a doctor, what is it they want to do with their careers, who is it they want to serve, those answers have to make a difference to you as an admissions committee. If someone tells you that they want to come into medical school because they want to serve the underserved, they want to make a difference in health disparities, they want to help communities thrive, that to me, there's a lot of weight. If you tell me you want to do research on a disease or on a complex that impacts a community that doesn't have very many people studying that particular phenomenon, I'm going to say that's a person we need in medicine, because we need to have somebody who's going to be thinking about those sorts of things as research projects when they get into medical school and beyond. So those are the sorts of parameters that we can look at in the holistic view of an individual, people with leadership who will drive an agenda, people who can teach. One of my favorite questions when I used to interview medical students for medical school positions was, you know, what's the Latin translation for the word doctor? It's teacher. So go ahead and teach me something, because you're going to have to teach patients later on how to take care of themselves. So go ahead, teach me something that you think I need to know. And people would get stuck at that position, trying to figure out what it is they're going to teach me and how they're going to teach me. But then you'd see people who love that. It could go right into a description of something that you really had no idea about. And now you know a lot about because they were able to communicate. They were able to reach you and understand. And that's what we need doctors to do. And those are the sorts of things that we need to look at when we're admitting medical school classes.
Dr. McDade, is there any advice you'd like to give to residents specifically?
I think the biggest thing that you can do to help people through residency program is to instill confidence, to stop forward feeding, to really mitigate the microaggressions that you can think about, and maybe stop yourself before you do it. The urge to say, well, you've got a very complicated name, I'm just going to call you this. That little sort of thing is enough to cause people to think that I'm not with you. You're not with me. Right. When I was chief academic officer down at Ochsner, one of the foremost scientists at Ochsner, the best scientist in my opinion at Ochsner, when I first met her, I said, I'm going to make you a star. Was a woman named Ebony Price Haywood. Ebony is a health service researcher of the highest quality. And she came into my office in tears one day because she was in a group meeting with a bunch of the folks who do health services work for the healthcare system. And she said, you know, Dr. Carmouche was there, you know, Dr. Hart was there. They all called him Dr. Carmouche and Dr. Hart. I got called Ebony. And that little thing was enough to set her apart and show her that she really wasn't respected in the same way that they were. Those little things are really quite amazing. And in residency programs, we do them all the time. And we've got to be a lot more careful about how we treat people and the respect that we give people to make them feel that they're actually important and part of the organization, part of the fabric of the organization.
Can you flesh out why that matters?
It's a tiny thing in our opinions because we're men. We have privilege. You know, you can call me Bill all day long. I've got an MD and a PhD. It doesn't matter to me. But for Ebony, it matters because she recognizes that women are marginalized. And that, in fact, you are continuing to marginalize the contributions that she makes by doing that.
You hear the word ally thrown about a lot. And I'm wondering if you could share with us advice on how to be a good ally.
I think that you really have to believe that the people who are coming in are just as good as you are. You have to dispense with the unearned privilege that you have because you're a white man, for instance, and really try to put that aside when you start thinking about what people have overcome to get to where you are right now alongside you. You know, I kind of chuckle to myself when people ask about what my experience was like on the faculty of the University of Chicago, where I was the only African-American probably the last 15 years that I was there, and in anesthesia. And to me, I worked alongside these people. I trained a number of these people over the course of the years. But the problem is that the people who are a minority just didn't want to stay in academic medicine, or they didn't get hired. Well, in part, it's because we don't see them as our replacements. If you have a minority student, you're thinking, well, they're going to go out and serve their community. They're not going to want to stay here on the faculty. And the answer to that is no. You've got to groom them the same way that you would groom other people. And as residents, you've got to treat them the same way that you would treat other people, with the same career aspirations that you have, with the same thoughts that what they're going to contribute are just going to be the same importance of the stuff that you're going to contribute. And I think we don't do that enough. We don't make people feel welcome. When I was a resident, there was a group of residents who used to play basketball at the Charlestown Navy shipyards every Saturday morning. And, you know, everyone was enthusiastic about me coming to play basketball on Saturday morning with them. But were they also as enthusiastic about having me study with them when they were preparing for their exams? You know, those are the sorts of things that you got to ask yourself, whether, you know, you're seeing a difference in the way that you're being treated for one reason versus another reason. And you got to ask yourself, you know, what can I do to make things different? And I think we have to challenge ourselves, ask questions about things that we just think are just normal. and say, what could racism be operating here? And let's see if we can get rid of that unearned privilege that we have, unasked for privilege that we receive, the benefit of the doubt that other people don't get, and see whether we can further the light. Being an ally, you know, just having the language when you see something disturbing happen to step up and say, that's just not right. What do you mean by that? You know, I differ with you on that opinion. Giving people the language to respond as an ally, what we now refer to as upstander training, is important for every resident to experience. And I think back to my intern year, so that almost 30 years ago. I think about a situation where a third-year medical student was on service with me. I was an internal medicine intern that night. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and we were writing. I was writing my last note, and I'm saying, I'm gonna crash for a while, but before I do, I want to buff you on your presentation tomorrow because I really want you to shine when you're doing your talk. And so he said, no, I got this. It's down pat. It'll be no problem. I said, really, this is your first major presentation. You got to get it hard. You got to get it right. You got an attending who's going to ask you a lot of tough questions. So he said, nope, I got it. Don't worry about it. So we go into the bedside. We're presented at the bedside. It's an oncology patient. The whole room is filled with the teams. You got four interns on two different teams there. You got two junior residents, two senior residents, two fellows, the nutritionist, the social worker, and the attending. And this is the worst presentation I ever heard in my entire life. Just absolutely abhorrent. So we walk through the laminar flow room. We go all the way out in the main hallway. And the student who presents, who's African-American male, about 6'1 or so, is now confronted with the attending who's just incensed by this terrible presentation that was given at bedside. And he grabs him by his shirt and tie. He pushes him against the wall. He gets his face right up in the other face, like the old Marine drill instructor. And he says, if you ever present a case that is that poorly constructed, I will see to it that you never graduate from medical school. Now, the whole two teams are sitting there listening to this. Anyone in the hallway who's walking by can see this. And he's doing it right in front of everybody. And who steps up and says something? Nobody, including me. I'm the intern on the service. You know, I'm not even going to stay at that hospital. I did my training for my preliminary year at one place, and I was going to go to another residency. I didn't say anything. That's what the problem is. When you're not prepared, when something like that happens, you have to be prepared to step up to try to say, you know, it was my fault. I should have buffed him. It's not all his fault. And no one deserves to be treated like that. And that's really what the difference is. That fellow is still an attending physician. Still, no one ever said anything to him about it.
Is there any more advice that you would like to give to our listeners?
Well, start where you are and do what you can. So if you can't do it at all, you can't build a program, you can't be a PI on a RWJ grant, you know, work where you are, work with what you have to try to make a difference. You don't have to change everybody. I often think of the old starfish question where the little girl's walking along the beach and she's picking up starfish and she's throwing them back in the ocean. Somebody comes up to her and says, you know, you're not going to make a lot of difference by just throwing one starfish. There's starfish all over the beach. And she looked at them and she looked at the starfish and said, well, I'm going to make a difference for this one. And she throws it back into the ocean. Well, that's what you can do as an individual physician. If you can't run a large program, if you can't impact a lot of lives, impact one. And try to make a difference for that individual by really guiding them and mentoring them and letting them become the successes that they can be, that we need them to be in society in order to try to change the things that we see that need to be changed to improve the healthcare and lives of all.
Well, Dr. McDade, thank you so much for joining us today and for such an informational, eye-opening, and fascinating conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time.
All the best, Dr. Stryker. It was a pleasure to be here and to talk to your audience.
That's a wrap for this episode. I hope you all found this conversation as enlightening as I did, and I hope that it inspires you to keep having these important conversations with one another because it really matters for our patients. Please join us for future episodes of Residents in a Room, the podcast for residents by residents.
Tap into the collective experience of the ASA community for real conversation, meaningful connection, and valuable support. Continue the conversation at community/ASAHQ.org. Join us for Residents in a Room, where we'll share timely info, advice, and resources designed to help residents in residency and beyond. Find us wherever you get your podcasts or visit asahq.org/podcasts for more.